Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Okay, well, everybody, today I'm excited. We have U.S. men's national team, former national team and Hall of Famer, Bruce Murray with us. So welcome to the show, Bruce.
Don, thanks for having me. I can't wait to unpack all the stuff that you may have for me.
Yeah, you know what? I just wanted to have a conversation with you, Bruce. And I wanted to kind of get a feel for, you know, what took a guy from youth on into Clemson, winning a national championship, on into Europe. So I thought maybe we'd want to unpack some of that, and maybe we could talk about some of the guys that you played with. And so how did this thing all start? I mean, where did you grow up? Let's start there.
So no, great question. Thanks. I grew up in Washington, D.C. area, a town outside of D.C. called Germantown, Maryland, which is maybe 20 minutes from or 20 miles from the Capitol. And I started maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old. I tagged along, and my older brother was on one of the first MSI, which is Montgomery Soccer. It's a big, big organization here. He was on one of the very first teams, one of the seven teams. And I was five, and they needed an extra player. And I'm sure you've heard this before. So I was the tag along brother, and all of a sudden they're like, we'd like to have your brother join the team. So it started that way.
And was your dad coaching, or was it you just playing on your brother's team? Or
my dad was the coach for sure. My dad coached us. He was one of the original coaches. My dad's Scottish, and obviously soccer's in the blood. So we grew up playing soccer, but it wasn't where I started at 2 years old or anything. I was five going on six when I started. So.
Yeah, so you start to go through the system and everything. So what age did you realize, or did you ever realize, or maybe did someone point out to you that you were different as far as a
Not player? Really. I was going to say, and that's a great question, because I was always – my dad was a guy who was not large on handing out lollipops. he was the kind of guy who was like, you could do better. And I didn't ever get that I guess feeling of I could really get somewhere until I was coached by another Scottish gentleman named John Kerr, senior, who played for the New York Cosmos, played with Pelé, and his son John Jr. is now the head coach at Duke. And John Sr. gave me kind of that, that, hey, look, you know, you have so much ability, and let's get to where you need to go. So really, but it was never patting you on the back. It was hard love. I mean, it was really tough coaching. And then I ended up going to college playing for a very tough coach. So I never was one of those guys that was told, you know, you've got this and you're great. No, never. It was the opposite. And I got so lucky for that, because I think that's a huge positive in my career.
Okay, so you're going along. So what age was that when you started being coached by John Kerr Sr.?
About 13. John Sr. had been traded to the Diplomats, and my dad and John knew each other from Scotland, and they were fast friends. And John Sr., my dad knew, you know, he even told me now to this day, he's like, you know, it was time to push, you know, I'm a golf pro. I'm a Scottish golf pro, but John Sr. Will be able to help you. And so, you know, that was the time, 12, 13 years old. Yeah. Where I met John Jr. a little bit earlier, but we kind of became fast friends, and the rest is history.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's get into that history, because, you know, the one thing that it's not exactly the same anymore, but there was a time when most of our U.S. national team was coming for your area. I mean, the original, you know, U.S. national team all started out of St. Louis in that area. with the Italians way back in the day in the 30s. But then it kind of moved to the East Coast, didn't it? With name some of the guys that were national teamers from the general Northeast area of the country up your way.
Oh my goodness. You know, from Maryland, you had Desmond Armstrong, Scott Cook, Jeff Gaffney. You had from New Jersey, you had John Harkes and Tab Ramos and just unbelievable talent.
Miola,
absolutely. And just we had so many good players. DC was the hotbed at some point, you know, for soccer. And I know it shifted then to Texas and California and so forth, but DC was incredible in terms of the talent level.
Yeah. So you're playing with John Kerr and all of us remember John also. I mean, John was a great player and then went on to coach it at Harvard. And in fact, you coached at Harvard. We'll get there in just a minute.
Sure. But sure.
I'm going to walk everybody kind of through the timeline of one of the greatest, I consider, you know, you one of the greatest nines in U.S. history. And so you're playing at 13, 14, 15. So you start getting into the high school years. So what starts happening as you're approaching college?
So we start looking at colleges. There was no shortage of offers or people that wanted me to come and play at their school.
Now, were you in the national pool at this time? Did the national pool already know about you?
I was in the junior national pool, you know, U18. I played a lot of games with Tab and John Harkes and other players, Miola. But then it was the college decision, and there was many opportunities. I went to, you know, UCLA, I went to Duke, I went to all these visits, and you know, I remember going to this is an era when my dad, I had a really tough dad, you know, really, really decision-making dad. And he said, you know, enjoy that visit out to California. You're not going there. And then he said, you know, he's like, you know, love John, but you're not going there. John's there. I mean, he's a freshman of the year, established All-American. We went down to Clemson and I didn't even want to go on this trip. And I remember going there and, you know, and it was a spring day and they were playing. And I just remember the conversation with the coach, him showing me around the campus. Ibrahim was his name, legendary coach in college soccer. A lot of your listeners may know Coach Ibe. And he, unlike one or two of the other coaches I had been to, he said, listen, you're the missing piece. I've got so much talent here around you. All you have to do is pull the strings and you're going to come in and you're going to be a star. Right now, you tell me what 17-year-old doesn't want to hear.
Right.
And he may have sold me the biggest dummy in the history of the world, but sure enough, he didn't, because when I got there, it was incredible. I had Nigerian players that could run like you've never seen. I had English, Swedish, and he was right. It was just getting on the ball and facilitating. I ended up, I think, my freshman year with 14 goals and 12 assists, you know, and I think I got the freshman of the year that year. But it was one of those things where you had to buy into the vision. And I remember I was like looking at my dad after on the way home. He's like, not you. He said, we're going to Clemson. So that tells you kind of how it used to be. I know a lot of parents give, you know, I have five children, so I give them as much, you know, decision-making capacity as I think they need. But my dad was old school and that's what we did. And it was the right decision. It was a wonderful decision.
So you go to Clemson, you're freshman of the year, things are going well. How's this, you know, how was that received by, like, were there older strikers on the team that were kind of resentful of what you brought in, or was the team pretty cohesive? Had the coach done a pretty good job of making sure everybody knew what their roles were?
You know, in both, right? It was cohesive, but also, yeah, I mean, we had a senior striker or two that lost time because of me, and it, you know, they didn't make things easy. But that's the great part about it's a process, right? You have to go through the process. And I'll give you a quick example of what I mean by that. So one of the senior strikers, and I won't name him, they were allowed to have a car, and the freshmen couldn't have cars. It was about a 3/4 mile walk from the dorm down to the Jervey Athletic Center. And I can't tell you how many times they would speed by and they would all throw their hand out the window and give me the finger, right? And say a few choice words. And I had 3/4 mile to walk to think about what I was going to do at training that day. And so those guys did me a favor. And I can't tell you like how many times we've emailed each other. And I said, listen, one of the reasons I got to where I got to was because you didn't give me a ride to practice. So, I mean, it's little things, Don, but it's true. Those are the things that make your DNA, right? Your soccer DNA.
So, you know, this is Inside College Soccer. And so, you know, we talk about all things, and this is one of the issues that I see. You know, I coached for 22 years in college, and I saw this type of phenomena happen every once in a while, where a freshman superstar would come in and older players would not be happy about maybe having to step behind. So how did you deal with that? Obviously you talk about how you responded, but like internally, that self-talk, do you think you were always driven that way to take that as a challenge? Because Bruce, I'm talking to clients and I'm talking to freshman players. A lot of them, when they come across that type of adversity, they want to transfer. They want to leave. Yeah. They want to quit. They don't like it. So what do you think maybe made you a little bit different in that aspect? And then what advice would you give to freshmen that are finding it difficult maybe to get playing time, or, you know, are being given a hard time by older players, that resiliency that we talk about, right? What advice would you give? So both aspects, how did you deal with it? And why do you think you were different? And then what advice would you give to young players?
No, that's just a great set of questions there. How I dealt with it was kept my nose down and, you know, one foot in front of the other and just worked as hard as I could, right? I'm going to outwork you. I don't care what you think or what, you know, I'm going to work. I'm going to make every useless run. I'm going to chase every lost cause because I want to get your respect, right? And that was important. Because we had so much talent down there. I mean, it was a ridiculous amount of talent, right? We ended up winning 2 national championships in Division I, so that tells you the amount of talent. So what I would give advice to young players is just come in, do your job. You're coming in at the bottom of the totem pole. I don't care how good you are. I don't care what club you played for, right? You're coming in. And you're playing against a grown man. You're trying to get a job from a guy who's 21, 22 years old, right? You have to go in there respecting, and you also have to absorb as much information as possible, right? As much film as you can study, right? If you're going to play, for example, let's say one of our clients out there is going to play against Duke or whatever, you know, get all the, you know, find out everything you know about the 2 center backs, right? Go through the film, right? Look, don't let any stone go unturned. Talk to the senior who's been there for 4 years, right? Make sure that you develop these relationships. It's all about communication. It's all about relationships because, quite frankly, everyone can run and everyone can jump and you all look exactly the same, right? It's the soccer acumen, right? The technical ability, the drive and determination, but also the communication, right? The communication is so critical, right? Both on the field and off the field.
So, you know, I did a tweet about this. You know, I'd been talking to one of my clients and he played for the national champion Solar. He was their starting center back, very good, big kid, 6'1", very athletic, but relied a lot on that athleticism and not as much on the technical parts of the game. And so then now he goes into college. He's playing for one of the top Division II programs in the country. And, you know, they've got a Japanese center back and they've got, you know, super technical kid, and they've got another kid from England, super technical player. And he's struggling with playing time, and he's struggling with that emotion of, for the first time in my life, I'm not the superstar. For the first time in my life, I'm having to compete for even getting a minute of playing time. Right. And so I posted about this, that it, look, it takes time in college at many college programs. There is an apprenticeship, so to speak, that has to be done with younger players. And a lot of the responses coming back to me, Bruce, are, well, the college system is broken. The college system is broken. It needs to be better. There needs to be reserve teams. There need to be places for players to actually play games. What would be your, having coached at Harvard, having been in your shoes, what would your response to that?
Is the college
system broken?
No, it's not broken. There's nothing wrong with the college system. I think it's one of the greatest systems in the world. And I get criticized for that, but I'll tell you why. You ask any player who played at Clemson and won two national championships, who the most important people were in his life, in their lives. And it would be the guys, the 11 that matched up every day in training, who never hit the field. We had some of the hardest games I've ever played would be the inter-squad scrimmages. Guys that never got a minute, right? They made us who we were, right? And, you know, as they went on, they, by the time they were sophomores, juniors, or seniors, they were on the field, right? And they served their apprenticeship. So, no, I think it's a necessary piece of the game. And it's something that people have to, players have to go through. You have to suffer a little bit to be successful, right? And that's suffer in a bad way, suffer in a good way, right? It's part of the game. And you know, you're right. I mean, there's so many kids are in the transfer portal and, you know, that's the way out. And sometimes, you know, it's been driven by a club coach or a mom or a dad. You got to let your kid go through the process, right? Nobody wants to not play the player that doesn't. I mean, every coach is going to put out the team that he thinks is going to make him better and keep his job. So it's just like you have to figure out how to do that. So, you know, that would be my answer to that, to be quite honest with you.
I love it. And I love hearing that from your perspective, because as we walk through this, so now you're freshman of the year, right? You go into your sophomore year. What happens your sophomore year at Clemson?
Yeah. So, adversity hits. I got injured. I blew a groin out, playing up at George Mason. We had flown up here to play a tournament and I blew my groin out and I had a real long recovery and I tried to come back early and it was very frustrating. It was very frustrating. And I started to question myself. I didn't know. It's weird. When you're injured like that, you don't feel like you're part of the team. I know that. I don't know if people know that, but you know, every guy, you know, everyone's so busy with what they're doing. Now, all of a sudden you're just kind of in the training room and you're an afterthought and you're like, God, man, I, you know, I don't feel like I'm part of the team. So that was kind of an off year for me. But you know, I got through it, but it made me appreciate the fact that, I can get back to where I was and get even further. I was never one of the guys that was always, you know, I never ever cared about how many goals I scored or read the paper. None of that mattered to me, right? It was just playing. I had the joy of playing and just loved to play. But that was a very adversarial part or year for me. I mean, I just, you know, I kept trying to play and I kept hurting myself and I finally took the time off. I was a guy that played through everything and that, you know, nowadays, I don't know if they recommend some of the stuff that we played through, you know, bad ankles and stuff like that. But yeah, that created some real inner strength for me, right? Because I had never been in a situation. I had always been
right.
Everything was kind of hand. You know, you hear you're doing great, you're doing great, you're doing great, and all of a sudden, man, you're not even part of the team because you're injured. And that was more self doubt than the teammates because they all were like always like checking on you and stuff. But it, you know what it's like when you're injured. The kids just don't feel like they're part of it.
Yeah. Okay. So you struggle a bit yourself. So here you are, freshman of the year. What year was that, by the way, that you entered college?
1984.
So 84, freshman of the year, sophomore year, injured, difficult year for you. You go away for the summer. I'm assuming you work on rehabbing and fitness during the summer.
And you come back your
junior year.
Yeah. And we got knocked out of the playoffs. We had a really good team. And we just underperformed. And so it was obviously disappointing. And then things changed. So you got to remember, I was a 10, I was a 7 all the way up to this point. And then I come back for my senior year and the coach says, you're going to be the 9, right? And I'm like, I'm not a nine. I see the game in front of me, not with my back towards the goal. And he says, no, you have to, because we have all these freshmen. We're very talented, but we're very unpredictable, and we need your leadership up top, right? So now I really didn't know anything. A lot of people don't know this about me, but I never played the center forward position until then. So, and a bunch of people will tell you I was better, you know, in the midfield, but anyway, I learned the position. We had a number of incredible leaders on that team. We had a guy named Paul Rutenis, who was an All-American, who was, you know, he ended up at a high level, maybe the vice president of Dick's Sporting Goods. And then we had Jamie Roots in the midfield, who's the president of the Dallas Texans. So there's a reason some of these guys got to where they got, is because they were leaders. And so we had these leaders, and we had all these young guys, and now we're the guys who are leading the young guys. It's actually, I had such an amazing career at Clemson, because my freshman year, I came in with, and I had all these crazy good players. And, you know, I had Nigerian guys who were 27 years old around me playing when they had the old rules. Right. And then the senior year, I got all these, you know, 17, 18 year old freshmen. And I'm kind of like in charge, so it was in terms of the leadership and stuff like that. And I really enjoyed that, because I was never really a captain. I was always a really good soldier. But that was the 1 year of my career, literally just 1 year, where I had to drop everything and like do everything for the team. It was just I became a leader that year. But I've never been asked to captain after or before. It was just that 1 year. And I thought it was very eye-opening to me. And it was a great, great part of my development.
So you're moved to the nine. Now you got to play with your back to goal. Now you've got to hold the ball up. You've got to combine with the players around you. You've got to figure out a way to, obviously, when you're a nine, the pressure is, right, you better score goals, right?
Yes.
So what happens that year? Walk us through how that season and led to the ultimate, right?
Yeah. So we slowly came together. After a slow start, and we kind of limped into the ACCs, and we got knocked out right away in the first round. And a lot of us were unsure of an NCAA bid. It was probably we would be the last team in, and we ended up, back then it was 24 teams. Now it's 48, but we got the 23rd bid. So we did, we snuck in, right? But people have to understand the ACC, and it hadn't changed much, is so hard. And every single game is contested. I mean, I was a coach at Harvard, and the Ivy League is exactly the same. It's very, every game's contested. It's just what level are you contesting it at? And we felt we got the bid. And they announced we're going out to Evansville. And there was just, you can't even tell you how happy everyone was, because we're like, we just played North Carolina, Wake Forest, Duke, NC State. Now we're just going to go play Evansville. Who are they? Where are they from?
So so you're going to SIUE, right?
Yeah, we're going out there. It's Evansville, whatever. And then, you know, in Indiana, and of course, you know, nobody really knew the hit. Indiana was like one of the best teams in the history of the planet. But we're like, Indiana. I said, well, and I just remember looking at my teammates, and we're like, we'll take Indiana, no problem. So, and sure enough, we went out to Evansville, and we won. And then we went out to Indiana, and we won. And then we just started, you know, snowball effect. And we ended up winning our semifinal back against North Carolina. And then we beat a very famous player for U.S. soccer historians. Here's Eric Winalda in San Diego State, coached by a guy named Chuck Clegg. And, you know, that was, but that team was not, you know, we limped into the playoffs, but we got a break. That's how hard the ACC is. We looked at the other teams, and again, they were all tough teams. Evansville was a tough game. Indiana was a tough game, but Rutgers was a tough game. But those teams, you know, maybe get a change of scenery, whatever it was the right tonic for us. So I ended up with a bookend, right? A freshman year, you know, being led by the seniors, to my senior year where I became the leader, And I scored a bunch of goals, 21 goals, and I think 20 assists. And I got the Herman Award, which is the Mac Herman Award, which is the Player of the Year. I always talk to John Harkes, and I always tell him I'm the one that won the Herman that year. So, so we always talk about that. But it was a magical year, and just a great place to play and grow up in terms of learning how to you know hone your game and hopefully see what's next, right? What's next after college? And we talked about this. And I'll just say real quick.
I wanted to talk about this, Bruce. Exactly. Yeah. You made a statement to me that I had never really thought about.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important for young players, even in seventh, eighth grade, right? To think about how much do I love this game? So why don't you talk about, you know, that statement? And I know where you're going with this, but I want everybody to hear this from you.
Absolutely. You look at the statistics, you know, how many kids play high school soccer, right? The varsity team, right? How many kids go to college? How many kids play? So I always looked at this. And again, from an early age, can I make the junior high school team, right? Can I make the high school team, right? Can I get to play in college? And I always looked at it as extending my career, right? I wanted to extend my career as much as I could extend my career. And, you know, then it got to college. And then I was like, can I extend my career? I'd really like to do this for a living. And then I got to be a professional. And then I got chosen to be on the Olympic team, right? Can I extend my career? Can I get to the World Cup? And I really looked at it. And if you don't look at the you know, you what do they say when you have 17 problems, you know, tackle them one at a time. I think that's the best advice I ever got was learning how to tackle it one step at a time and extending my career, right? Until your career is over, right? And then it's over, right? But you want to just fight your tail off to extend that career, right? And there's a lot of guys out there, and maybe college kids are going to listen to this podcast, right? There are so many opportunities for you that I never had. I mean, an American player going to Europe, an American player, right? And you guys now have a viable league. You have a great way to make a living. You know, you can make a very good living in the MLS, or you have the quality to go to Europe, right? Or you want to go to Europe, and you know, there's super opportunities there as well. You know, for the people that kind of pioneered this, it's made it for you guys a little bit easier. Right. But there's the opportunities out there for you are absolutely don't just think college. There's more out there than college. There really is. If you get to the, don't think if you're at Division III or NAIA or Division I versus Division II, they'll find you. If you can play, they'll find you.
That's great advice. And I really appreciate the fact that you said that, because we do try to preach with what we do at SRUSA. It's not just D1 or bust. It's find the right fit for you, find the right coach, find the right team, find the right institution to help you be the best player that you can possibly be, right?
No question about it. No question about it. I mean, you have so many JUCO schools. I mean, down in Florida, you got Lynn College. I mean, you got some serious talent. I could make an argument with you that you could bring one of those teams in and play Clemson, you know, five times, and it's going to be 2-2-1. I mean, there's just so much talent out there. It doesn't matter where you go to school. If you want to extend that career as a professional, right, it's out there. Those opportunities are there for you, whether you're at Lynn College or you're at Clemson University or Stanford. It doesn't matter.
That's right. I always talk about lately the team is Charleston, right? And in West Virginia, they're number one in the nation in the rankings again. Yeah. And I say, boy, I would love to see that team against Stanford and against Duke and against Maryland. And I bet you if we play 10 game series, I bet you they pull wins out of that. So
I agree. I couldn't agree more, Don.
Yeah. So Bruce, so you win the national championship a second time. You're the recognized as the best college player in the country. What happens next?
So very interesting situation develops my spring of my senior year, right? So the game, the season's played in the fall. We win the national championship. And I get a phone call. Sunil Gulati, the former president of U.S. Soccer, has a connection in Turin. And they want me to go and train for a month and a half with Juventus, right? A U.S. international prospect. And I had become a U.S. international because over the summer, they switched coaches on the team, and Alex Panagoulias, the Greek former Greek coach for their Greek World Cup team, got let go by the U.S. Soccer Federation. And I ended up, you know, playing against England that summer out in California. And it was so I ended up being identified as somebody that they were, you know, interested in, Juventus, believe it or not. And so I ended up going over there for 6 weeks. It was the most unbelievable situation I've ever been involved with, because I stayed at a hotel, and the first day I was going to training, I got picked up by Ian Rush, the former Liverpool number 9, in a red Ferrari.
Wow.
So, oh yeah. And so it was the most, oh my God, I felt like I was part of the team. I've never been more welcomed by a group of guys in my life. These are superstars playing for Juventus. I was at training with Michael Laudrup, you know, I mean, just crazy, the amount of talent, but I did okay. They liked me. So, I ended up going, let me go back. So then I go, you know, obviously go to the Olympics, and then I end up in Switzerland, because the Swiss team liked what they saw on TV. So I came over there, and Juventus had the rights. And so I ended up being loaned out to Lucerne and got a chance to play for, a German coach named Friedel Reusch, and just an amazing time there. So I had some really interesting experiences, but to go over and train with Juventus. So it was funny because Steve Goff from the Washington Post called me when Winston McKinney signed with Juventus. And he says, I don't think anybody else knows this, but you were the first guy to sign with Juventus. I said, but not like he signed with Juventus.
Right.
But, you know, so I was a signed loan guy. I guess they could put me anywhere. They have like, I don't know. Somebody said like 30 or 40 clubs around the world that they loan players to, right, to keep eyes on them. So, but yeah, it was a heck of an experience. I'll never forget it. Yeah.
Yeah. People that are listening may not remember, you were part of that tweener class. So the NASL had just died.
Correct.
Not long. And then the MLS hadn't started yet. So
that's right.
There was no place for anybody to play in the United States, really. If they were of a professional caliber, right?
Well, there was a professional league, obviously the ASL, and there was a lot of good players and a lot of hard work, and you know, I guess it wasn't set up in terms of, you know, being a real job. It was you know, players would get paid by the game and so forth, but there was you know, enough to keep you going and ticking over. But yeah, you had to get to Europe to really get, you know, the experience. And I'll just add this real quick, is people say, well, you know, is it better to play for our national team? Is it, you know, players should all be in Europe, right? We don't need MLS players and they should all be in Europe. But, and so what I would say to that is yes and no. I mean, I will say that people don't realize this, is back when I played on the national team, we played Bayern Munich, we played Juventus, we played Roma, we played Sheffield Wednesday, we played Liverpool, we played everybody. We played because in order to get games, the U.S. team had to travel. So we would go, you know, play, you know, Partizan Belgrade. I mean, just name the team. Like we played everybody, and, you know, in AC Milan, right? I could just keep going, naming the names. So for the 85 internationals I played, I probably played 80 times in Europe for the national team. So I did play in Europe. I played in Europe both on a club team at Millwall and also in Switzerland, but I also played on the national team in Europe. And I must say that my game matured because of that, right? I really learned the ins and outs of the game by playing all those games. Now, saying all that, I think you'd be an idiot to think that you can win the World Cup by picking the 10 hot players that we have out there right now. Okay, everyone says Josh Sargent and McKinney, and we'll just put them all on the field and we're going to win the World Cup. That would be a disaster, right? You're going to need a couple of domestic-based players. You're going to need you know, you cannot veer away from that. And I think we've proven that over time with Bruce Arena and Bob Bradley and the teams that they've taken to the World Cup. But I for all the people that see all these great players that we have now, Dest and everyone, got to be careful. We have to make sure that we get the right combination of players, and both leagues at that point help each other out.
So you're okay. So you're in Lucerne, right? So how do you end up at Millwall? How does that translation?
So I come back from Lucerne because US Soccer now they gave me an opportunity, a full-time contract. And, you know, it was great. I was a six-figure contract as a kid playing. I had come from Lucerne and they said, you know, this Puma gave me a deal. It was great. Right. So, it was probably a little disappointing for Lucerne because I'd started to really do some good things. And the coach said, I can't wait to get you back because we're going to move to, let me just close this. Are you there, Don?
Yep. We're still here.
Yeah. There you are. Okay. They were at two foreigners and it was hard to get on the field as a foreigner, but they were moving to three. And he's like, I don't want you to go back and sign this contract. I want you to stay here. But Bob Gansler was telling me, I need you to come back here and we need to start training and playing games in Europe right away. So I signed the contract with US Soccer and then we played the World Cup. And then after the World Cup, I came back. I was still under contract with US Soccer and Boromila Tanovic was hired. I was in Bermuda with the national team and we were training in January. And Bob Gansler came into the room and, you know, he said some words and then he kind of said, and I too shall return. And I'm looking, what the heck is he saying? And Brian Bliss, who's next to me, he's an MLS assistant. And Brian hits me in the ribs. He's like, he's resigning, you idiot. I said, what are you talking about? Right. And he says, he's quoting MacArthur or somebody, you know, some general. And, you know, I said, oh my God. So sure enough, you know, that was it. He walked off and, we never really saw him after that. I guess he got a flight home, but, we were in training camp and nobody knew what the hell was going on, but Bob Gansler had just resigned. So, in walks Bora. And then the Federation said, we're going to move all of you who have contracts out to California and we're going to live in Aliso Viejo out in your neck of the woods. I'm California and we're going to train for the World Cup in 1994. So, you know, I did that for a couple of years and we went, okay, let me just tell you about those years. We trained in Aliso Viejo, but we were on the road 250 days a year. We were either in Europe, Asia, South America. It was insane. I've never, like, you talk about air miles. I can go anywhere in the world for the rest of my life. Bora Milutinovic got us going anywhere. We were in Spain one day. Then we were in Japan, then we were in Russia, and then we come home and we play Russia and Stanford, we play Portugal, play Italy. I mean, it was insane. I mean, it was like a traveling circus. Any of the guys you talk to that played at this time on that team, it was an absolute traveling circus. And now we're introducing new guys into the team. Kobe Jones, a California product that you know very well.
UCLA, right.
Exactly. Alexi Lalas, you know, the great Ziggy Schmidt. Coach, you know, became an assistant coach for Bora, Steve Sampson, right? All these people. So it was a wild time, that we saw everything. I mean, it was an incredible time. So at the end of that time, we went to the Copa America in, Ecuador and we got back from Ecuador and Bora Milutinovic, you know, pulled me aside and he said that, you know, I want you to take a month off. I'm thinking of, you know, I don't know what your future is going to be. And it was like a kick in the chest. I never knew what, you know, I'd never really gotten cut. Was I getting cut? And, Renato Copabianco, who was the team manager, you know, he told me, he said, yeah, you're cut. And, you know, I gotta be honest with you. I cried for about a week and I don't, you know, I don't want everyone to think I'm soft. I was a pretty tough guy, but I got for the first time in my life, I got told I wasn't good enough, like on the soccer field, like really cut. And I was devastated. And it's not one of those things where everyone can tell you, oh, shake it off and get on right away. it takes time. You got to figure this out. And anyway, I kind of brooded around, and you know, and I was I was still in California, and I didn't know what to do. And you know, and my phone rings, and it's Mick McCarthy, who is the manager at Millwall, and he's a very famous manager. He managed Ireland, managed Wolverhampton in the Premier League. He just managed his 1,000th game over in England just last week. And he called me up and he asked me, he said, "Are you looking for a game?" And I said, "What? Excuse me, sir." He goes, "Yeah." He says, "I've been talking to your teammate, Casey Keller," right? And in his Irish accent, I can't do it. I can do a Scottish accent. My parents are Scottish, but I can't do the Irish. But he says, "I've been talking to your teammate, Casey Keller." He says, "I want to have a look at you." I said, "Well, what do I do?" He says, "We'll send you a ticket. You're getting the next plane. And you know, come on, we're going to go to Millwall." So I went over to Millwall, and you have to remember now, Mick and I played against each other because I played Ireland twice and he was the center back. So we traded some serious blows. And so I went through the preseason in Ireland with Millwall, and he signed me and I got a great contract, and you know, it really set me up for a lot of things I do today, but you know, it was amazing. I remember sitting at signing, you know, he said, I just wanted to make sure. And that's why you were on this trip in Ireland and everything. He says, usually we sign players and we sign them, but I just wanted to make sure. And, you know, I knew that when I played against you twice, I knew what I was going to get. And he said, Casey vouched for you and said the same thing. So I ended up going to Millwall, and on opening day, we had some injuries with the frontline players, and I ended up starting as the nine. And I ended up that day at Stoke City, very difficult place to play, and I scored the winning goal. And it was absolutely one of the thrills of my life to actually have that, because I closed the disappointment of getting cut. Everything I knew, U.S. soccer, the U.S. system, I wasn't good enough, right? They wanted to kick me out, and yet here I am, at a very top level, scoring against a team away from home. And when I scored, the Millwall fans sang the Star Spangled Banner.
Wow.
Which, I mean, you could make a movie out of this, right? So anyway, it was, I guess the messages to all you players out there, don't give up, and don't feel like you have to suck it up. It ain't easy. And, you know, if you get cut or you get told that you're being, you know, replaced, you got to work hard. You got to work harder to overcome it. And that's my lesson. That was the greatest lesson that I ever had as a player. And it'll happen to every player, no matter how good you are. I didn't have any training for it, but I'm going to give you that piece of advice now. You'll get over it and you'll get back on your feet.
So what age were you at that time when you signed on at Millwall, when you scored against Stoke on opening day?
28 and a half.
Yeah. So starting to get a little long in the tooth for a field player, weren't you?
No question. I mean, it was a lot of young guys, and you know, and just for your fans out there, your audience, Don, the championship is 1,000 miles an hour. And I know everyone's like, oh, the Premier League and this and that. Listen, man, the Premier League teams don't like to go play a cup game at Barnsley because it's just going to be kick, chase, fight, battle. And you know, and you've seen it this year. You've seen some of these games. And it is what it is. And it's 10 more games than the Premiership. That's 47. And it's fury. I joked all the time. I remember my brother called me. He's like, you know, what was it like? I said, I don't know. I took a breath before the game at halftime and finally got to breathe after the game. I literally, it was like trying to find breath the whole game, right? Because it's so physically dependent, right?
Yeah, that's amazing. So we're gonna wrap up your career in just a second, but I want you to take us back to the shot heard around the world. I want you to take us back to what the US was going through. I mean, we hadn't sniffed a World Cup appearance in the finals in many, many years, had we?
No, we hadn't. And we should have wrapped this thing up 2 weeks before in St. Louis, we played El Salvador, and we really laid an egg. They brought a bad team too. They brought a young team, and it was very windy that day. And you know, wind's the one thing in soccer that's hard to deal with, right? You can deal with snow, sleet, rain, ice, all that. You want rain, right? The faster the ball's moving, but it was very windy that day, and we really underperformed, and I was poor. I had some chances, I didn't finish. So we ended up going to Trinidad and Tobago, and we had to win the game, right, in order to go to the World Cup.
Now, this is to they get us into the 90 World Cup, right?
Correct. And that kind of – that's propelled everything, right? U.S. has only missed once, I guess, last cycle. But, you know, it got Nike involved. All the big money poured in. U.S., you know, Soccer 94, World Cup. So we had to go down there and win the game. And it was a lot of pressure on the U.S. team for sure.
So take us through what the feelings were like tell us about the shot heard around the world for those that don't know about it. Tell us what it felt like as a team. Walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, let me kind of walk you through just getting there. Got on a plane. I'll date myself right here. Pan Am charter plane down to Trinidad and Tobago, and you know we're coming down, and the pilot gets on the thing and says, "I don't know what you guys are really into here. I know it's a big soccer game, but you know you got 25,000 people here at the airport waiting for you." And we're like, what? What's he talking about? Nobody had any idea. So we got into, I guess, where you get your bags. And all of a sudden, there was thousands of people, right, all dressed in red. And, you know, there's music and everything. And we got on the bus. And the whole way to the hotel was just streets lined with people, I mean, just like, I can't explain it. You know, ask all the UCLA guys out there, Paul Crumpy and all them, they'll tell you, the day we got to the game, or, you know, we're up in this hotel and they call it the Upside Down Hilton. You can look down to where the stadium is, and there's the whole stadium is just packed. I mean, it holds about 40,000. There had to be 65,000 people in there. There's people climbing up the walls. But when you look down, there's a mass of humanity, and on the field around or the cricket grounds, there's 100,000 people. There's another 100,000, like it's the whole country celebrating that they're going to go to the World Cup, because all they needed was a tie, and they're going to hammer us, right? It's hot. They're very athletic. The field's, you know, hard as a rock, and everything's going against the U.S. It was the most intimidating atmosphere. I played in bigger crowds, or I played at the World Cup. I mean, but this is something that you will never forget. And it was just incredibly, the game started and they're running and they're super quick. I mean, the athleticism of the Trinidad team is ridiculous. So anyway, we get a throw in, and Tab Ramos gets the ball, and he plays it to Paul Caligiuri. Now, again, I'm at the nine position, so I'm looking backwards, right? And Paul kind of gets a weird hop on it, and he clips it up over a player. I think it was Russell Latapy, and it goes over his leg. And now I'm in front of Paul probably 8 yards, and you'll see on the video if you look. And I see him, and then I pull off to the right, because I thought, well, maybe I can pull off to the right, then come back on a diagonal run. All Paul has to do is dink me in, right? Because there's about 20 yards behind me to the goalkeeper. So I pulled off to the right because I'm immediately going to cut back to where I came from. Paul will play it in. I look over. Paul's got his head down, and I'm like, no, Paul, don't do this. No effing way. And sure enough, he's going to shoot. So now I'm like, I'm backpedaling, like sprinting back. I'm like, he's gonna shoot this. And he did. And he shot it. Okay. Now, I love Cal, like everyone loves Cal. However, Cal's not known for left-footed shooting as an outside back, which is what he was, except for that game. They put him in the middle to disrupt things. Cal couldn't do that if you gave him 1,000 balls. But he did it on that day, and he hit it as sweet as you will ever see. And he hit it as hard as he could up, And the ball just, it was parabola effect. It just shot straight down. And the goalkeeper kept going back. And he literally kind of got a hand of it. He couldn't get, people said, well, the sun was in his eyes. I've never seen a shot struck so hard where the dip was wicked. And, you know, it was a miracle, Don. It was a miracle. You know, and Paul's going to tell you the same thing. But you know, thank God Paul did hit that miracle, right? And Paul will tell you, you know, that's normal for me. I'm good at the left foot.
Paul. That's Kelly.
No, exactly. Right. It's the greatest left footed player ever. All that stuff. But, you know, I can tell you this, that as soon as he hit it, I knew it was in. I knew it was going in. And two of their players were, you know, said something to that effect. And maybe the language wasn't so great, but they knew it was in too. And the rest of the game was just, you know, fighting your socks off. It was hot. We were under constant pressure. At that point, it was just trying to hold the ball up, right? People don't understand this about the game. You know, my job at that point with Peter Vermees was just to hold it up. And we're trying to do this, you know, under severe duress, because our guys are just firing it forward. And my job now is to try and make it as difficult as possible for them to get the ball and get it back up the field. I think the only time I ever played a more defensive game as a center forward is Italy in the World Cup, where we had to really be disciplined and chase them everywhere, keep our lines, and not let them penetrate. Right. So, it was just an amazing, shot and game. And, you know, we all owe Paul Caligiuri a debt of gratitude. Really, it could have been, you know, if it was John Harkes, we'll owe John Harkes a debt of gratitude. Because if you can put it down to one moment, it was that moment that has launched this new incredible boom of U.S. soccer. It was Paul's goal.
Yeah, and that's why we call it the shot heard around the world.
That's right.
It's amazing. You know, so you guys end up going to Italy, right? For the World Cup, right? And so I've heard some stories. I've been lucky enough that when I was in some of my A licenses renewing them, like I was in with Cali was in one of mine. In fact, my only claim to fame in my own mind was saving a shot against Caligiuri. And he said, look, I've played a lot of places, Don, best save I've ever seen. I know he was blowing smoke up my, but yeah. it made me feel good for about look at me, I'm talking about it 20 years later.
So
I've heard a few of the stories about the training and the accommodations and some of the setups.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Tell us just a little bit about what that was like for the U.S. team. Boy, you know, no veterans, right? No World Cup veterans of this group.
No.
This was the first go round for everybody, right?
It was, and it was. It was a college team, basically. You know, there was a lot of indoor players that were available. Chico Borja, Ricky Davis. Bob Gansler wanted to go with youth, and he also wanted fitness, right? And so it was hard to make the argument to take indoor players and get them trained and get them into the World Cup. It just, there's no offense. These are, I mean, God, I can't even tell you. Some of my heroes are Branko Sagoda and Stan Stamenkovic and the indoor game, but the indoor game doesn't translate to the World Cup level. And Bob made that decision. It was very unpopular, actually, you know, with a lot of people. But so we had a very young team. You know, a lot of guys just had college experience, and obviously, it was a good group. And as the tournament went on, we started to get our footing. I think we went into the first game naive against Czechoslovakia. And there, I remember, you'll get a kick out of this, is Joe Machnik is obviously one of the, you know, very, very famous guy in terms of,
legend,
you know, he's on Fox. And of course, as a goalkeeper, you would know who Joe is, but Joe was an assistant to Bob Gansler, and he was in charge of scouting the other teams. And, you know, he told us that, you know, you guys are going to be physically match up well with Czechoslovakia, except, you know, we come out in the tunnel and I'm looking up at Thomas Skoravi, the other center forward, and he's 6'5". And I'm like, what the hell kind of a scouting report is this, Dr. Joe? Right. So they kind of, you know, but, you know, we got, unfortunately, we got to 3-1 and Eric got thrown off and we were playing with 10. And so we lost 5-1 and then we had to play the host in Rome. Right. So, you know, everyone thought, my God, they're going to get, shellacked. And we actually, that was just one of the best games I think U.S. soccer has ever produced because we played exactly what we were supposed to do. We defensively sat back in blocks of four. We went for the counter punch and then we knew we were going to get a chance and we almost pulled it off. I got a free kick. I bent it around the wall and Zenga, I guess, got a piece of it, knocked it down. And now Peter Vermees is charging in and it's Peter, Zenga, and the goal. And he smashes it, did the right thing. And it hit between Zenga's ankles and the ball was spinning. And then it was hooked away by Ricardo Ferri and off the line. And that would have been the tie. So we went from there to losing against Austria 2-1 in the last game. But we learned how to play over those three games and U.S. soccer learned a lot from those three games. So, it was imperative that we were competitive and we ended up competitive, right? Were we competitive in the first game? No, but the body of work said competitive because we were going to host the next World Cup and that would have been just terrible to have an automatic qualification and not even have a competitive group. And so the world would see that as an embarrassment. So I thought that, you know, again, you talk about adversity, right? After that first game, you know, you hung your head, you would have gotten murdered by Italy. I mean, because it was, right. By the way, that Italian team is the best Italian team that they've ever put out on the field. You know, I make that argument. But we had to make sure that we made sure that we were competitive and that, you know, we weren't going to, just get an automatic qualifier. And sure enough, when they brought Bora in and what the U.S. did in World Cup 94, just showed the world that we're an up and coming nation. And there is a day that will come, you know, that we're going to win that damn World Cup. But, you know, I don't know when it is, but we will. We're determined. We're the United States of America. We want something. We will get it.
So what's it going to take? That was one of my questions for you. Yeah. Having been an insider, still having some connections, and I know you still meet with mm-hmm. people and talk with people. I know you're still consulted to some extent. We've had some of these talks, but so what do you think we're missing? What's it going to take for us to at least get to the next level of, you know, let's say, back into a Sweet 16 or an Elite 8, getting into that place where we're recognized as, okay, we could have a shot at this thing.
Yeah, I think we're on the right path. I think all these players that are going to Europe, the opportunities that have opened up for these players, the fact that they're playing competitive games in that atmosphere, that's a very big start. What we have to do is we have to find, and especially in this terrible COVID time that we're in, everything being canceled and put back and everything, we have to find a way to get all these great players training together, right? With their club commitments and everything, these two-day windows, they don't do anybody. I mean, that will not translate to at World Cup success. We have to get, them, for a sustained period of time, maybe it's after COVID, where they're, training, working. They really build that bond. I think one of the reasons that the U.S. did so well in 1994, knocking off Colombia, really taking Brazil to the limit, was we all lived together in Aliso Viejo, right? And we all trained together and we went out together and we hung out together. Can they create, they're never going to create that atmosphere again, Don, because it's not the way things work now. But can they create within the group? Can they, and we always talk about the group and I hear some people say, oh, what's this new term group? It is a group. It's a family. You gotta get your group. They all got to be on the same page. Right. And if you're not on the same page, you're gonna have to figure out how to get on the same page. But that's the key for me is team camaraderie, right? Cause you got a lot of good players here, right? Can we get them all on the same page? You know, do I know if I look off the corner of my eye, Don Williams, I know you're going to make that run. I don't even have to talk to you, right? Can we get to that point, right? That's the key. It's very difficult when you have, that's one of the negatives about having all these guys at all these different teams now, because they're all in different cycles, right? And you can't get everyone back, and you can't, it just changes the equation a little bit. So I say that because if you look at like Argentina, they always struggle to qualify for the World Cup because they get these incredible players from all over the world. They fly them in, they have 2 days to try and play together, right? So it's, I don't know what the answer is, but it definitely is something that we need to work on.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to put you on the spot, but I won't do it. I was going to say COVID's over. You're in charge for 2026. What would you do?
But that's okay. Well, I will tell you this.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know about being in charge. I'm not sure I would want to be in charge of that team, but I would say to my national team brethren, Greg Berthalder, didn't play with Greg, but I would say, when I first saw him come in, he had the right idea, which is like, I want to impart my ways. But when I saw them try and play out of the back against Mexico, I would tell him, let's not play out of the back.
Yeah.
Let's try something else.
Yeah. Playing to your strengths, right? Instead of as everybody tells you, you should play to what the true strengths are of your team. Yeah.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Correct.
We'll leave that at that because I don't want anybody to get upset.
Absolutely. Please don't do that. Yeah.
Okay. So look, I want to talk about what it feels like at the end of the career, right? So when did you finally know that, the boots were going to get hung up? How did that all come about?
31 years old, back from England, Millwall, signed with the Atlanta Ruckus. And Lothar Osiander is a Bay Area coach, very famous, coached me in the Olympics.
Wonderful guy. Coached at the Earthquakes.
He sure did. Coach for the first year MLS San Diego Earthquakes and San Jose Earthquakes. Lothar was a coach there, and you know, he called me in England and he said, I know you're playing right now, so I'd like to sign you. And so Millwall let me go, and so I signed with Atlanta. And we went to the finals that year. We played Seattle
Good fan base, right? Atlanta, really good fan base.
Unreal. And so what I know is that, you know, I had some knee issues that year, and I also even when I was healthy, I wasn't the fastest player. Good athlete, but not a great. I mean, some of these guys. I mean, God, when Kobe Jones came into the national team, it was like watching the Roadrunner go by, right?
Yeah.
You know, beep beep, see ya, right? And so, Lothar said, "Look, man," he says, "you're such a good player." He says, "Let's just put you at left back, right? It's the greatest season of my life. I couldn't believe it. I was like, I love playing left back." Right, because I didn't have to do the running or the sharp stuff that you have to do up top. But what I did realize is that he made a tactical decision because physically I wasn't there anymore. Right, injuries were adding up, and I couldn't run. And when you can't run, you get kicked. In professional soccer, you get hurt, you get kicked. And I remember, you know, we were playing. I don't know who we were playing. Maybe Seattle. And one or two of the guys, maybe it was Bernie. Who was it? I can't remember his name, but you know, he picked me up. He says, "Man, you're getting slow. you're getting slow."
What
you're
year was
old.
This, Bruce? What
it
year
was like?
This?
It was like 1996, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, 96, 97, and that was it for me. And I decided to walk away. I mean, I could have played another year. In fact, MLS had the draft. And Lothar called me and said, I'm not going to waste a draft pick on you, but I want you to play for me. And I didn't, I refused the contract. Sunil Gulati called me, you know, we need you in the league. And I decided to walk away because I only wanted to play at a level I felt like I could play at. And for that season, I was substandard and I was getting kicked and I wasn't as good as I needed to be. And I didn't want to be that way. I didn't want to play that way. So I could have taken another 3 years out of it, but I don't know what that would have done long-term to me. And I just felt like I wanted to enjoy life again. Right. And when I say that, I don't say that in a bad way. Maybe people take it the wrong way. I should clarify it. When you're playing at national team level and traveling and, it's 10 years of having the flu. It's early mornings, it's late nights, it's film. You just don't feel good the whole time, right? You go to a qualifier in Costa Rica and the fire alarms are going off all night. The ambulances are blaring horns and you get 1 hour sleep.
That's not accidental, like, for people who don't understand those, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a coincidence. Exactly. I've been told stories about coming out of the tunnels and things being thrown on you and you had to be, horrible, huh?
And then trying to go out and get points, right? You hit a point, right? We're all athletes, and they make that decision. So mine was pretty early, 31. But you know, I got a good professional ride out of it for a decade, and enjoyed it. But I had some obviously disappointment and adversity to overcome as an older player. And so all the younger players out there need to understand that, it's part of the game. It is a process. Your college recruiting, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to have a coach at a big school who's going to say, yeah, we want you. And then all of a sudden they're not going to have as much interest in you because guess what? They found somebody else and it happens. And it's not a bad thing. And you can't get mad at the school or the coach. You know, and most coaches are very transparent and they're very honorable people in this business, especially the soccer game, I found. But you're going to find where that happens to you, and then you're going to have to overcome, and you're going to have to go to plan B, and you're going to have to and you can't hang your head or everyone else who's doing the same thing is going to run right by you. You know what I mean? So
it is a business. Yeah. And people need to understand that.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Yeah. So Bruce, what are you doing? What are you doing with yourself nowadays? Now that you're not playing anymore? Well, obviously you went on and coached at Harvard. Maybe we should talk about that real quickly. You coached with your best buddy, John, right? John Kerr.
I did. I'm just trying to make sure that this, I'm make sure the power doesn't run out on me here. For some reason, it's not. Take it home 1 sec.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on. Oh, I tell you what it is. It's okay. Cause I have the headphones on. So I coached at Harvard with John and coach youth soccer. And now I run a school called the Accelerator School, where we have 10 full-time students, and we're going to continue to grow this school. And we train every day, and you go back to your club at night, right? You train with your club, you train here every day. I'm a big believer in the little things because I think everyone's the same. You know, everyone runs, jumps, and runs. It's pretty simple. But in terms of the technical development, the little things, how you strike a ball, strike through the middle of the ball, you know, little things like body position, where are your hips, you know, if I give you a scenario, do you have the three options? All those things are making you a player, because I really feel like everyone's is similar athletically, you know, at every level, you know, so.
Yeah, very, very good. And that's why you know, you and I connected, I don't know, about a year and a half ago when you were working another gig at a facility there in Virginia. And we were talking about doing some stuff. And, you know, I was really excited when you reached out to us. And why don't you tell everybody about the partnership that SRUSA and the Accelerator School of DC metro area.
I'm sorry, Doug, say again. I missed that.
Yeah. Talking about you and I had hooked up a couple of years ago when you were working another gig at a facility there. But since you've been at the DC Metro School Accelerator, DC Metro Schools with SRUSA, we've hooked up we recently inked a partnership deal. And why don't you tell everybody about what that means to the players that are at the Accelerator School?
Yeah, so we're fortunate enough to have gotten together with SRUSA. We have three of our players here are getting ready to be college eligible, and SRUSA has really opened up our eyes in terms of what we can do, bringing players in and offer a full service. Right, instead of me, I know a coach or this or that. You know, we have a profile. Automatic college profile. You come in here, you update your profile. We have all the resources that SRUSA can afford us and provide for us. So the partnership is absolutely fantastic for us. We feel like we're getting more than we're giving, but you know, we just can't thank SRUSA enough. Thank you.
Well, thank you. No, and honestly, it's, you know, the whole idea I had with SRUSA when I came on board was bringing in buddies of mine, former college coaches, four guys that were connected, and then forming a syndicate. Because, you know, who you know or who I know, you can't know everybody at every level everywhere in the country. No one person can do that. But
that's right.
As a group now, we're, you know, we just had a meeting this morning, right? You look at the 11 guys that were in that meeting, and between those 11 guys, we're one phone call away from any coach in the country at any level. And so can act as a group now, right? As a syndicate. And all in the benefit of the players on the one side, right, Bruce? And then helping our coaching buddies on the other side who, you know, your buddy John Kerr at Duke, you know, can't be in California and Virginia and Texas and Canada and England all at the same time. Just that the staff isn't big enough to do that, right?
No, that and you know, Duke's jet is kind of being used by the basketball coach too. So
That's right. Besides that, right? Exactly.
No, but the other thing is that we have this amazing relationship and partner. We have obviously the European side of in the South America, African side of SRUSA, and you know we here at the Accelerator School, you know, work with a group in Malaga, also in Buenos Aires. So we, you know, we feel like we have options, not just college, after college, right? Looking at other places to play. But if I have a really good player here and I think he's a D1 prospect, I can actually take him from my school and send him to Spain for a month and, you know, see what the coaches there think. And I think that's really important, you know, especially when you're placing players, you want to make sure that you have the right fit.
Yeah, exactly. And the Malaga City FC, that was the amazing thing, is I'd start talking to you and we've had a partnership with Malaga City FC, and then find out you guys had the partnership with the Accelerated Schools. It's like, oh, this was a match made in heaven. We know all the same people.
We do.
It just shows you how small the world is, right?
Yeah, especially how small the soccer world, right? In the coaching community. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Bruce, is there anything else that you'd like to plug? I know you've got an academy there, by the way. Tell us about the Bruce Murray Soccer Academy.
So the Bruce Murray Soccer Academy is not the school, but what we do is we teach technique, small group training, and it's really cool because we operate out of the Bretton Woods Country Club here, and it's the IMF World Bank Country Club, right? And
yeah, I saw behind IMF you golfers there. It looks beautiful back there.
Yeah. It is. We got a decent day. It's got that marine layer, Southern California haze, but we're having about 70 degrees here, Don. So, I know you're not jealous yet, but this is an amazing facility we have here. But what we do in the summer is we run camps and clinics for the World Bank and the IMF kids. And we will send a bus down to the World Bank. And the best part is, and I can't tell you how many parents have told me, Mom, Dad, come to work at the World Bank, spend time with their kids, send them off in our care. We feed them, we train them, and we get them back on the bus. They drive home with Mom and Dad. I can tell you, every year I have parents that are like, this is really the only time that we've had quality time when I could take my kid into work and show them what I do. And it's just great because we can provide that. And it has nothing to do with soccer. It has nothing to do with soccer. But, you know, and not the level, it's summer camp basically, right? But to have the stories about the parents, like a parent from Spain telling me, you know, we just moved here and I just joined the World Bank and my kid feels at home. He's playing soccer and it's cool.
Very cool. Very exciting. And for all of those listening, stay tuned, COVID dependent. We'll be doing a joint event with the Soccer Academy, with the Country Club, with SRUSA. It will be coming to your area very, very soon. We're working on that, everybody. We're working on that. And players will be able to come in from all over the country and experience all of the things that you're talking about and learn from, again, what I consider one of the top nines in U.S. history. Bruce, I want to thank you for coming on with us. I really appreciate your time today.
Don, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, and I can't wait to do this again sometime.
All right, Bruce. Well, we'll talk to you soon, and you take
care. Thanks,
everybody.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.